Welcome to the podcast, Entrepreneur Perspectives, building and protecting your business one podcast at a time, a Kesshorse family production. In this episode, we discuss the life product review, becoming an expert in the life insurance industry. Our guest today is Bobby Samuelson. Bobby is the owner and executive editor of The Life Product Review. The Life Product Review is a website providing independent and objective life insurance product intelligence through articles on life insurance issues and quantitative reviews of new product offerings. Bobby is also a frequent keynote speaker at industry and corporate conferences. He has authored and co-authored articles for publications such as Trusts and Estates and has been quoted in the Wall Street Journal. He currently lives in Charlotte, North Carolina with his wife and kids. With Bobby's compelling stories from the insurance industry to building his business, we are excited to share Bobby's story with you. Let's bring him in, Bobby Samuelson. Bobby, welcome to the Entrepreneur Perspectives podcast. It's great to have you.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
In the office too, no doubt.
Yeah.
So, Bobby, you have an incredible story. You've been on quite a ride, as I understand it. So I want to talk to you a little bit today about the ride that you've been on and where you're going. So, you told me a story a while ago that you started in business and here you are and you're trying to make some way, but take me back a little bit before when you're in college and you're trying to figure out what you want to do with your life.
Oh man, that's way back. So I always wanted to be a real estate developer, and that was everything I ever wanted to be. When I got my license at 16 years old, I started driving around town looking at houses, looking at, you know, that's just what I loved. My dad's been in the insurance business since the 80s. My granddad was in the insurance business since the 60s. But neither of them really ever told me what they did for a living. So insurance was not something on my radar. So I was in college, 2007, had a couple of job offers in the real estate business, thought that I was going to go do that. And I don't know how else to describe it other than that something did not feel right about the real estate market in 2007.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So lucky me.
That's good insight.
It's very good insight. Very lucky. And I was actually graduating a year early from college. So I kind of made the decision to graduate a year early and go into the real estate business. So I ended up actually turning down two job offers from firms that actually later on went bankrupt in the crisis. And finally talked to my dad and said, "Hey, Dad, what should I do if I'm not going to go into real estate?" And he said, "Well, have you ever thought about the life insurance business?" And I said, "Absolutely not. You know, is that what you do for a living?"
Yeah,
that's right. But I was an econ major, so I was triple majoring in business, accounting, and economics, and I graduated a year early with just the econ major. And I had a real math background. That was, you know, my favorite part about economics was the econometrics side of it, and my favorite part of that was statistics. And so I went into insurance kind of blind to the fact that I think I had a pretty natural skill set for it, but until that moment when my dad brought up life insurance, it had never crossed my mind.
So you get in the insurance business, right? I mean, so many people say, "Well, how did you get in the insurance?" So I kind of just fell into it, or I got tricked into it, or
yes,
you know, or someone was in the family and they just started, "Well, I have to do insurance."
Right.
You kind of went a different route with it. You get into the insurance business. What was it like right off the bat?
Yeah, so I got in, like you said, everybody falls in a different way. I didn't fall on the sales side. So I went to go work for, at the time, the largest distributor of life insurance in the country. And I was going to do a rotational program where they would sort of, I was a test case. So they basically said, "We're going to make you an intern and you're going to rotate through and then you're going to go back and work with your dad and sell life insurance. But we're going to kind of train you on the technical parts of the business before you do that." So my first day on the job, I was in the product area, and I remember sitting down at the computer and pulling up this application called WinFlex, which I'd never heard of before, obviously. And I ran my first life insurance illustration and I fell in love. And it immediately was apparent to me that these are complicated financial instruments. They're not really insurance policies. There's a lot more to them. And that there was just, I don't know how to describe it other than there was an unending depth of things to know about when it came to product. And also it was pretty apparent to me too that not a lot of people in the life insurance business were product experts. There's a lot of people who were good at selling it. There's a lot of people who knew how to underwrite it. There were a lot of people who sort of understood the corporate side of it. But people who really loved product and devoted themselves to the study and the practice of life insurance product, that I didn't know many people like that. But that was me. I knew right away that that was what I was supposed to do. And so they kept trying to rotate me through the program. And I was like, no, you don't understand. Like, I don't want to go anywhere else. I am supposed to do life insurance product. And so that's how I got into it. And so I can honestly tell you from day one, I fell in love with it, and really, honestly, I haven't looked back since then.
Yeah, well, I just used the word before, insight. And so you had insight when you walk into the real estate companies. You're like, something's wrong here, something's not right. I remember walking in, actually, to mortgage companies, because I was getting all these job interviews at the time. I think it was between jobs, and I was like, well, I got a lot of mortgage interview jobs. I must be really ready to do this. And I'd walk in, and like, the amount of people in the room, it was like boiler room. And I was like, well, I can get a job here. Then you kind of walk out, and you're like, something's not right. I don't know what it is, but they shouldn't be hiring this many people. Right. I actually had a job at DLJ Direct early on in the dot-com era, and the same thing. And every day there's like new training team company or new training people coming in.
Yeah.
Didn't seem right. Again, bottom fell out there, mortgage business. So I thought maybe I did have some good insight, but you're taking this insight to the next level when you get into the insurance business and you're looking at WinFlex Web. And for people that aren't in the insurance business, WinFlex Web is like the main hub to run any permanent illustration.
Yeah.
And here you are, you see it, you love it. And then you take that insight to the next level and say, wait a second, there's no product specialist in here. And I can vouch for that, right? You know, there's someone at an insurance company, they might have a product specialist that knows their stuff, but you're talking about product specialty in the entire marketplace, right?
Yeah, and I didn't see anybody in that spot. I also didn't see people who just loved it the way that I loved it.
Right.
You know, there are people who knew about product, but they didn't really, I was, you know, all my friends were still in college, right? I was living in a brand new town. I had no friends, I was not married, I didn't know anybody. And I literally just remember, I remember going to the office on the weekends sometimes just to run illustrations, just trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
And that's how much it captured. I remember dreaming about it. I think most people, it takes, you know, they graduate from college and they're just kind of plugging away. And for me, I became immensely interested in what I was doing. And I think that's, so I had the insight, but I also had the interest. And that kind of, I think for a lot of people, those two things.
Match those together.
Yeah, a lot of people, those two things don't come together. But for me, they came together.
That's the true entrepreneur, right? Where you just, whatever it takes, you're going to figure this thing out, even if that means you have to dream about life insurance illustrations, which most people don't do. But what you did is you started creating your own category.
Yeah.
So we can go into the insurance business, and you immediately fall into, you're an insurance agent, or the real estate business, you're a real estate agent, and you're doing what everybody else is doing, but how can you do it differently? So you get into the product space, you start working on it, you obviously love it, which obviously we talk about all the time. You have to have a passion for what you're doing, hopefully, and happen to be really good at it and have a skill for it. You get into that business. Where does that take you next?
Yeah, so I worked at that company for a couple of years. And then what I realized was that, to your point about kind of being a new category, the category I saw for me was a support structure for high-end life insurance producers. So for people who are not familiar with the space, they think of life insurance salespeople as sort of selling simple term insurance products, maybe. What we worked with, the people we worked with primarily, were ultra high-end life insurance producers, people that you knew from your days, you know. And these guys, they are mostly guys, are selling, you know, very large, complex insurance transactions for estate planning purposes or business planning or whatever. And they're really good at selling, and they're really good at explaining life insurance conceptually. But when it actually comes down to doing the analysis and putting and choosing a policy and designing a policy, they're not great at that, right? Those are two very different skill sets. And so I saw this new category, which was, why don't I work with these ultra-high-end producers? I'll take a percentage of the commission, and I'll do all the analytical work for them. I'll go visit the client with them. I'll explain why we chose this policy over that policy. I'll find anomalies in the products and help that sort of fit into the planning structure that the advisor wants to use. And so I figured that would work. And then I quit my job to find out if it would work for real. So I left and started this little company that did that. And I signed up, I think, 7 or 8 kind of big producers to be my retainer clients. And I started working on it. I would basically just get cut in on cases. And so, like you said about new categories, I mean, the new category I was trying to invent was sort of a market for being a product expert, which worked, you know, pretty well. Like pretty much right away, I think there was an acknowledgement that, hey, there's not a lot of this going on in the industry. There's just not a lot of product experts. And so these independent producers saw a need for it. And it was an interesting little business model that I started out with.
Yeah, so a company start hearing about this, right? Because now the carriers are starting to get wind. Here you're out doing these things, and all these other big companies are out there. What is this guy up to?
Yeah.
And you start meeting him probably at events, right?
Yeah.
And you start having conversations with them, and then what happens from there?
Yeah, so I did get a little bit of notoriety because while I was at the insurance brokerage firm, I worked a lot with producers while I was there, but I also became an expert in this product category that nobody knew about and nobody cared about, called Index Universal Life, which at the time was like, I mean, they literally gave it to me because I was the intern and no one else wanted to deal with it. But it's an interesting product. It's got a lot of, like, you know, it's got a lot of derivatives angles to it. It's a more complex life insurance policy than usual. And so that got me interested, obviously. And so your point, I mean, once I left, I started talking about that product and sort of got asked to speak at one conference about the product, about IndexedUL, and the company started to take note. And I suddenly realized, oh, there's not only can I work with producers on sort of individual cases, but maybe there's a category in this business for an independent commentator on life insurance product, which there isn't one. There wasn't one in the life insurance business. And so when you look at investment management or annuities or other, really any other kind of industry, you almost always have sort of an independent voice on what's going on in that business. And that didn't exist for life insurance product. So I realized pretty early on, I think that there might be a role for me as an independent voice into the product side of life insurance business. So I spoke at that one conference. Somebody at that conference asked me to speak at another conference. And I went to go speak there, and they paid for my travel and my hotel. And someone came up to me afterwards and said, hey, I want you to speak at my conference. What do you charge? And I was like, oh, I can charge to speak at a conference. So I said, I don't know, like maybe $1,000. And he was like, done. By the way, you need to charge a lot more than that. And I was like, oh, this is actually a business. And I had never thought about public speaking as a business. So you kind of fast forward over time, and I ended up doing, hundreds. I think I've done over 500 speaking engagements at all sorts of different conferences in the insurance business. But again, to your point about creating a new category, there was no other person doing that, being an independent voice on life insurance product. And I kind of fell into that. I didn't realize that it wasn't obvious to me there would even be a niche in how I would make money doing that, but literally I just spoke at a couple of conferences and realized, oh, I can literally make money as a public speaker.
Right.
Going around and talking about this stuff.
You created attention in just whatever it is that you were doing at the time. People took note of it and said, hey, we'd like you to speak. And we always talk to entrepreneurs about, like, you never know what that next thing might be. Stay in the game.
Yeah.
Stay, keep being creative with everything, and you never know when it's going to happen. And it's funny, I think I told you this when we met last time, is I think we said it was San Diego, but I'm sitting in the last row of this huge conference, and I think there's probably 600-700 people in the room, and I'm in the last row. I got there a couple minutes late, and some guy sits next to me. We chatted, said hello, and the next thing you know, they called the keynote speaker up, and you get up and you walk up to the stage, and I was just like, wait, I was just talking to that guy, and I had no idea at the time. He happened to be from Charlotte. I was from Charlotte, and then I think we kept hearing about each other, and like, hey, let's connect some more. So I saw firsthand the speaking, and I remember you getting up on stage and talking to a few guys like, well, he really knows what he's doing, and this is unique to the industry because not a lot of people are doing that.
Well, and I think at that conference I was the ripe old age of like 26 maybe.
Yeah.
So that was the other thing, is I was the youngest guy. I mean, you and I were probably the youngest guys in the room,
right,
by a pretty good margin. And yet, if you're an expert in something, the age stops mattering.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
How do you handle that? Because the insurance industry it's an aging industry, and not a lot of younger people coming out of college are saying, hey, you should go be in the insurance industry. Like, no, that's not the word, quote unquote, sexy enough to go into that business, go into real estate, go to be a financial planner, go build a tech company, all these different things. But all of a sudden there's this open market, right?
Yeah.
There's this white space in the insurance market, which you saw, and now it's still there. How do you look at the insurance industry today compared, and we'll get back to a little bit more of the journey, but how do you look at the insurance industry today compared to maybe when it was your dad's, when he was in his prime?
It's a great question.
And he probably still is in his prime, right?
But yeah, I think so. He definitely sees it differently than my granddad even saw it. My granddad's a classic sales guy, and he was extremely successful selling insurance, but his main skill set was the sale. He was a great salesman. My dad is really about the process, and most of his business comes from professional advisors. And so his attitude is, I'm another professional advisor. I need to have it. In the same way that an estate planning attorney has a clearly defined process, I need to have that too for my business. And so he's really all about the process. And then you kind of get to me, and I'm really more about the product. And I think it's just different sort of lenses on the insurance business that all work in different types of markets. So I think what the market needs has changed. I think what works in the insurance business has changed. But like you said, I think one of the biggest problems we face is that not enough young people are getting into it, because they see that, oh, it's a boiler room sales situation. Well, I don't want to do that. I want to go do something else. Well, the reality is insurance doesn't have to be that. There's a lot of different ways to get into it. And I think what it showed me was there are a lot of ways to get into an industry. There's a lot of ways to get into insurance. And for me, a lot of my friends would ask me, they'd be like, wait a second, you're getting paid to speak at a conference and you're the youngest person there. How did that happen? I'm like, well, you got to realize, guys, all of you went to go work in the investment banking business where everyone's as smart as you are. And that's where everyone goes.
Right.
So no matter how big of a fish you are, right? It's a very crowded pond. I went into a world where nobody young is coming in. And that creates an opportunity in and of itself, because it is a viable industry, and it is a real part of, you know, the financial services world. It just doesn't attract a lot of young, interested people. But I'm seeing more, though. I feel like, you know, when I first got into it, I was really young. I didn't see anybody my age, and now I'm a little older, you know, mid-30s, and I'm starting to bump into some very successful insurance people. And they are, to your point, they're doing it differently than my dad did it. They're doing it differently than my granddad did it. And they're really successful. And part of the reason, we've all talked about this, you know, part of the reason why they are successful is because they don't have any competition, you know, because there aren't a lot of young people getting into business. So to me, that smells like opportunity, you know. I understand why people go to where all the smart people go, but there's something to be said for going where everybody else is not going. One of my best friends runs a trash business, and he's been very successful with his trash business. Well, that's because nobody wants to get in the trash.
Right.
And he's made a killing on the trash side of the world that you would never think of, because it's not sexy.
Yeah, which goes back to the whole thing about insight, right? And having and the vision of, wait a second, I can go here, and I can do well, and I can enjoy what I do. Right. You have to have both, right?
Yeah.
So it has to work that way. So going back to where you were on your journey, you're getting paid to talk, you're showing up to these conferences. Did that continued for a long time, of course.
Yeah,
and then you start seeing different ways to continue to refine what it is. I love to use the word refine, because we're, as entrepreneurs, we're always looking to know, how can we refine our business? How can you update it? How can you grow into something different? When did you start doing different things as you're speaking, as you're going to these different events?
Great question. So the producer side of my business, I let that kind of atrophy, because it was a very high touch, very involved, time consuming part of what I was doing. The payoff could be great, but at the end of the day, it wasn't what I really wanted to do full time. So I loved the speaking thing, and I realized, to your point about refining, okay, how do I kind of refine this so that I'm doing less kind of producer work and more speaking and things like speaking. So I don't remember when this happened exactly, but at some point I was flying, you know, over 100,000 miles a year. And I realized I'm on the airplane all the time. What should I do with all this time? And I've always loved to write. And so I thought, you know, maybe I'll write this free blog that will fuel into more speaking engagements. So I started doing that, and I wrote, I don't know, 3 or 4 posts. And I wrote a particularly nasty post I was too young to realize you don't poke the bear, right? So I wrote a nasty post about a very big insurance company, which I was right.
Right.
But it didn't matter. It was still a nasty post. And something like 7,000 people read it. And I thought, oh, this is interesting.
So you said 7,000 people read it. Where did they find it? Was this only on your website?
People started, I mean, it's, you know, it's a, the life insurance business is a small world.
Right.
And I wrote a nasty post about the number one life insurance company in the independent side of the world, and it got passed around like wildfire.
So it was a link to your website that people were sharing around?
I just made like a little free blog on
okay.
I called it like the Samuelson Design blog. I knew any branding, any marketing, whatever. I just sent a few. I'd written a white paper that had been broadly distributed earlier that year. That was my first kind of experiment into writing. And so I think I sent it to the same distribution list who had read the white paper or something like that. So then I thought, well, you know, all right, I got all this time on airplanes. I love to write. I wonder if I can monetize, you know, written content. So if people are paying me to speak, maybe they'll pay me to write too. So maybe a month later, I worked with a web developer, rolled out a subscription-based website, set the price at what I thought was a ridiculous amount that no one would pay, and God, I'll never forget, Eamon Walsh was my first subscriber. He subscribed 5 minutes after I wrote it, and I called him and said thank you. And it ended up being you know, a really successful, not particularly time-consuming endeavor that I loved. And so basically my life then became speaking at 100 or 120 or so engagements a year, flying 200,000 miles a year, and while I'm in the plane, I write blog posts.
Yeah,
and that was pretty much the business model. So I, you know, I'm not an entrepreneur in the typical sense that I had a bunch of employees. I was a solopreneur who, to your point, was just trying to refine that business model to where I could get paid. This is what I always said: I want to find ways to get paid to think, write, and speak. And whatever way I can get paid to think, write, and speak, or any combination of that, is going to fall in my wheelhouse. So that started to include, you know, work with life insurance companies. They hired me to do consulting work, all sorts of things like that too. But again, trying to refine it down to just speaking, writing, thinking, and getting paid for that.
Focused. Like, you were completely focused.
And it was all product.
And finding the time, I always say that, I tell John, who's in here as we record this, and I wrote some articles recently, and I sent them, and there was like 7 articles, and I'm like, get me on a plane more often, because everything's blocked out, and you have to do it. It's either that or just sit there and stare at something, or I didn't want to watch a movie, you know? And that makes a lot of sense. And there's 2 other things that I see in there is, people always talk about, well, how are you going to get on social media and how are you going to do this and how are you going to do that? Well, the bottom line is that's all important. There's no doubt about it, but good content wins. So if you write something that's good, it's got a chance to break through. There's a lot of noise out there, so it still might. It might hit two people and then stop. Okay, that's fine. Just keep going. And then not to say, let's just go create something polarizing to be polarizing, because we know a lot of people that do that. Yeah. You just state how you truly believe about something. Maybe stay away from the politics or some of the, unless that's what you're into, right? If you're in the political world, hey, by all means. But if you create something where there might be two sides to it, that's okay, as long as, like you're saying, you're the expert and you can defend your thesis on that.
Yeah, it's a fine balance that I had to learn the hard way. So there's a difference between, so I agree with you about good content. I had a lot of people say content is king. I would hear that a lot. And I say, well, why don't you invest more in making good content? You're just copying stuff other people have written. So for me, it's like, okay, how do you create good content? What's the definition of good content? And to your point, it's that I have to believe it. But 9 times out of 10 for me, that's creating original analysis. So I spent, it wasn't just like I would sit on the plane and write. I mean, I remember most plane trips, I was crunching numbers. I was reading through insurance company statutory filings. I was like an investigative reporter trying to find the angle that no one else was talking about. And honestly, if I look back over my career has been made by 3 or 4 things that I realized before they were public that I talked about that no one had ever heard anyone talk about before. And that's why I got hired to be a speaker. Yeah, I mean, I'm moderately entertaining. Like, I'll throw a few jokes in here, but at the end of the day, people hire me as a speaker because they know that I'm going to get up and show something that they have never seen anywhere else.
Yeah.
And that's because I'm putting in the hours and hours and hours and hours and hours it takes to create really original content. And that to me was the key to everything I was doing, was trying to really get an angle that nobody else had. Not because I wanted to just do what nobody else had done, but because, again, there's not many people in the insurance business who are asking the kind of questions I was asking, and so it wasn't that hard to find something that look, for example, you know, back in 2012, this was product Guaranteed UL, and everyone knew that it had some kind of complexities beneath the surface. Well, I actually started reading and cataloging all these obtuse contract language, and what I realized was that there was some really nasty stuff buried in these contracts that literally no one was talking about, and I started talking about it, and companies actually had to make official responses to it and change their contract forms, but that was because I put in the time for the original analysis.
Right, you didn't just throw that out there one day hoping it would stick.
No,
right.
And that's what people always ask me, like, aren't you worried about getting sued? I say, yeah, of course I'm worried about getting sued, but that's why I do the analysis.
Right.
Because if you're going to come at me, you got to prove that I'm factually incorrect, and it's my job, the hours and hours and hours I spend on the analysis, to make sure that I'm at least mostly factually correct. And if I'm factually incorrect, I would, and I had to do this a couple times, I would write a post recanting a previous post.
Right.
And say, hey, I was
prove
wrong.
Prove me wrong, right.
Yeah, or no, I would even say, I was wrong, here's what I got wrong, here's why I got it wrong,
right.
And here's the conclusion, now that I fix it.
Yeah.
And once companies realized that I would do that, they wanted to work with me. They would call me up and say, hey, you didn't really get this part right or whatever. And that ended up being immensely helpful, having those relationships.
Well, and that's being humble enough to know that. First of all, you knew that you knew what you knew. And you were able to put it out there and feel good about it. And, of course, people are going to make mistakes. But you're humble enough to know, well, I can fix that. I can make that right.
Yeah.
And I think that's something, but going back to your earlier point, is you had to put in the time and the effort. This is not something you just thought about, you know, glossed over, and then just sent it out there. You're hours. But like you said, like, you're in your 20s and you're going home and you're running illustrations. Like,
yeah.
You have that in you. Not everybody does,
that
right?
My life. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
to create the content, you have to put in the time behind it. You have to really think, you have to get deep, or emotional, whatever type of content you're creating, if it's analytical, if it's in, you know, educational, or if it's whatever it might be, maybe it's just entertainment, but really think and get deep in it.
Yeah, and I think that was the big thing I saw, was just people want authenticity. For me and my brand, authenticity is analytics and unique content around that. I think a lot of people get that wrong with content creation. They go for stuff that people can find elsewhere. And I don't know, maybe that works for some people. But for me, it was always about being authentic and not copying. Like, taking what's good from other people, but building on it myself.
Yeah.
And putting my own. I've had a lot of people offer to write for me over the years. And I'm like, you don't understand. If I don't write it, it's not me. And if it's not me, people don't care.
Right.
So, no, I appreciate the offer, but I don't want a ghostwriter.
Right.
For that exact reason.
And you need... And they want that third party, that independent source of someone who's really, they trust you at this point, right? They know who you are, they like you, they trust you, they know, like, trust. And then you're able to put that out there. And at the time, I feel like if you go to Amazon or Google reviews, for example, and I just want to buy a product, I want to buy a microphone, I want to read reviews about that, I want someone who doesn't work for the microphone company to tell me what their experiences were with it.
Yeah.
And maybe for a microphone, I can get 500 reviews. For a life insurance policy, maybe I only can get one because there's only one that exists. But in a time where trust is everything, like maybe more than everything, you come out with the life product review on these life insurance contracts that people can say, I can get my third party and, you know, feelings on this. And then I can still make my own decision. Maybe I read something, you're like, no, I disagree here or there. That's okay. You're just giving me the facts. And now I can do something with that. So I think at the time where Amazon's growing, Google's growing, and you listen to it, look at a podcast, there's reviews in the podcast, so I can learn about it. Maybe not all those reviews are the right reviews, and, you know, maybe they're family members, all that kind of stuff. But that's the point of reviews just in general, I think, makes sense. When you say the life product review, it's like, yeah, it's good timing. Doesn't hurt either.
No, yeah, I totally agree. And at the time of the insurance business, things were getting complicated.
Right.
So it was the right time for someone like me.
Well, they needed trust because the industry was losing trust because their products weren't, you know. I've had multiple calls with very large insurance companies. And let's say it was a policy from the 70s or 80s, and I couldn't get anybody on the phone to answer the questions that I had until they found someone in the basement and they got on the phone and then we worked it out together.
Right.
But it was complicated. They were losing trust at the time, and agents were losing trust, and, you know, there's Dateline specials or whatever to show that they were putting out there for some of the annuity contracts that existed.
Yep.
And people, they needed someone to come out there that was trustworthy and that could put out this type of information. That's what you've done.
Well, and I think the biggest thing to your point about trust is, so you're right. If people agree with me, disagree with me, that's beside the point. The main thing is that I'm putting things into light that were otherwise hidden in darkness. And if companies have to publicly correct me, all that means is there was more information now in the public than there was before. And so, you know, my main goal is for the life insurance industry to grow and thrive. And I think the only way it does that is if people trust the products. And if me, I'm the only guy out there calling insurance companies out, more or less. And if that forces insurance companies to be more transparent, no matter how wrong I am, no matter how much anybody disagrees with what I said, if the truth gets out, and again, things that were in the dark come to light, that is good for everybody. And insurance companies won't do that unless they're forced to do it. And so I think in a lot of ways, my career has been forcing companies to go into the light on things that they were not comfortable doing. But ultimately, we're better for the industry because they finally did go to light. And you got to have somebody out there who's willing to kind of stick their neck out a little bit. And that's what I did. I, you know, again, in my 20s, I didn't know any better. And now in my 30s, you know, with the next iteration of Life Product Review, I'm a little more careful. I'm a little less bombastic. I'm a little more analytical. It's a lot less my opinion and a lot more just the facts. And what I found is that's the right tone for the times now.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of have to adapt with what the overall vibe is in the industry. And for me, being bombastic in my 20s at the time where the industry was absolutely the right thing. Or I'd say absolutely. I think it was probably the right thing. And now I need to be a little more mature and a little more measured in how I approach some of these topics.
Sure. As you continue to refine, right?
Absolutely.
Keep growing with it. So,
absolutely.
So Life Product Review is doing well. We'll give the link at the end so people can go if they want to subscribe to the Life Product Review. I think that would be awesome. The material on there is different. It's unique, and you've not seen this anywhere else. So we use it at CatSource on our insurance side of our business, and I know a lot of other advisors out there, brokerage groups, do the same thing. So I would encourage anyone to at least check it out, get the executive summaries, right, that you have, and learn more about the business, learn more about the reviews that you're leaving out there. What's going on for you going forward? I mean, because what I've seen is this tendency to continue to refine your business, and that's what we look for in entrepreneurs. So Life Product Reviews can continue to go. I'm sure you're helping out other advisors that exist in the marketplace today.
Yeah.
Any exciting changes that you see maybe overall, either within your own business or within just the industry as a whole as it grows? I mean, we've just seen a lot of changes from the whole life market, and you mentioned Index UL before and Guaranteed UL. Like, what's that? That was 5 years ago. It's
the
biggest thing ever. Now what's going on? So what do you see going forward from here in the industry?
Yeah, so I think my business is a creature and a reflection of the industry as a whole. So I can't talk about my business and how it evolves independent of how the industry is evolving.
Yeah.
Just kind of like what you're saying.
Yeah.
So I think the industry is in a really interesting place. You know, whereas the rest of the financial services world is going towards low fees, simplicity, transparency, the life insurance industry is going towards high fees, high complexity, you know, low transparency. And I didn't, so I worked at MetLife kind of for the last 3.5 years in between my stints doing the Life Product Review. And when I left MetLife last year, almost a year ago today, actually, I wasn't sure I was going to want to do the Life Product Review again. I didn't know if the industry needed it. And so I spent about 6 months kind of poking around, trying to figure out, okay, does the industry still have things in darkness that need to come to light? And is there still a role for someone like me to do that? And the answer was resoundingly yes. So I think our industry has got to get to simpler products, more transparent products, more information in the public sphere, you know, lower fees, just alignment with where the overall financial services industry is going. And when that happens, I don't know if you're going to need a Life Product Review anymore. For the time being, I'm going to keep writing about all the crazy stuff that's coming out in the market. I mean, you know, like every new product that comes out has some weird wrinkle in it that requires someone like me to spend hours and hours and hours trying to figure it out.
It shouldn't be that way, is what you're
saying. It should not be that way. I didn't want it. I mean, I love doing the Life Product Review, but I wish our industry was so simple and so transparent that you don't need me to do this. But instead, there needs to be someone like me. I mean, the example I use is back when I did the Life Product Review back in like 2012, 2013, it would take me, you know, 5 hours to figure out a product. You know, it's a couple of wrinkles here and there. I've got a bunch of proprietary models I build. I put it in there, and usually pretty straightforward. And I'd write the review and be done. Now, I mean, one review for one product has probably taken me over 100 hours. For one particular product, you know, the final result was like 25,000 words about the product because it's that complicated. It's that undisclosed. There's that many moving parts. I had to build an entire model to replicate the product in my own Excel spreadsheet to figure out all the things that they weren't telling customers and then write cohesively about how they work and what that means. And unfortunately, most products that come out these days require that type of analysis. So for me, the Life Product Review, you know, as long as the industry insists on making highly complex, you know, low transparency, high fee, high leverage, high illustrated performance products, I'm going to have the Life Product Review. I would love to, in 5 years, close it down and say, hey, we're in a better place as an industry. We don't need an independent arbiter the way that we used to because these products are so simple and straightforward that you don't need someone like me. That would be my hope. You know, I don't know if any entrepreneurs like hope for their own obsolescence, but I think.
But you're going to refine anyway, so it doesn't matter. So
it doesn't
if
matter,
I took
exactly.
it away from you today, which I'm going to do in a couple minutes, we'll do a real quick rapid fire approach.
Yeah.
I'm going to take it away, but that's what you look for. You try to say what's going to put me out of business,
absolutely.
And you're okay with that because you're like, I took that away from you. Well, you'll just go create something else.
And it's obsolescence on my terms. It's like it's obsolescence the way that I think it should happen. And yeah, I will have planned for that. Long in advance, you know, and so that's where I think, and I think the industry will get there. I think there's going to be some lawsuits. I think there's going to be.
Well, it has
changes.
To be because what you're saying is, if it takes you that long, and you've done this for a while,
yeah.
So you know, there's other people out there that know what they're doing too. But let's just say it takes you that long to understand a product. So I'm gonna take it as some salesperson in some insurance company somewhere is gonna call themselves an expert of that product. When, yeah, maybe they've studied it a little bit, but there's just no possible way they could have taken it to that level.
No way.
Because they're under, you know, they have to sell so many products to keep their job.
Yep.
So that's a scary thing. It's frustrating in the industry, and I talk about this all the time. We're in the insurance and marketing industry, and I'm like, it gets a bad rap, both of those industries, and being in these industries for long enough for a good reason. Because
I
see the bad that happens as a result of people saying things that just aren't true.
Yep.
And it's frustrating, and then you see clients, they're like, well, they're so turned off and have such a bad taste in their mouth because they've been burned so many times in a row.
But it also means for guys like me and you, we also see the opportunity to do good.
100%. 100%.
And I think that's the thing that keeps, I mean.
We say that, and I agree with that. Now that's become a cliche that people, I know you've been burned before. It's like the guy said it to the girl, right? Like, I know you've been burned before. And
but I'm different.
But I'm different. I'm the one, you know, but it's true. Like, if you can be genuine and prove it, and that's what it is, proof of concept. Because you could say all these great things, and I could go read your Life Product Review, and I'd be like, this is terrible. It's not, by the way. But I could formulate an opinion on it. And then, but it's proof of concept. And I read it, I'm like, no, this is really good stuff.
Yeah.
He told me this. It's proven itself out. I talk to other people. They feel the same way. Now it starts to add up. It's just like your speaking engagement. It just builds. You plant seeds and it just grows from there.
To your point, it's got to be authentic. It's got to be real. I'll tell you a quick funny story. We were in a sales situation recently. My dad and I were working on a big case. And there had been another agent who sold a ton of policies they should not have sold to this family. It's like over $3 million of insurance that should not have been there. Or it should have been very differently. It's like, it'd be like buying a Ferrari to go like off-roading. Like it doesn't, okay, not the right car.
Work,
yeah. Yeah, put the Ferrari on the track. Okay, buy a Range Rover.
And that's your thing, by the way, right? Is using cars.
Cars analogy. Yeah, I ended up doing car analogies a lot. But so we had a meeting with him, and the turning point of the meeting was when the CEO of the company, it's all corporate and stuff, looks at me and he goes, now tell me about that dividend rate. Because all these guys come in here and tell us about the dividend rate. And I go, yeah, it's made up, it's garbage. And he dies laughing, he goes, I knew it. And from that moment on, we had credibility, and it was authenticity, and it was like all he needed was somebody just to sort of give the nod that, hey, the insurance business has its wrinkles, and we're here to help you navigate that. Totally changed the end, you know, they hired us for the engagement, all that kind of stuff. So that's where I kind of get back to saying, I think authenticity matters a lot. And in the insurance business, authenticity goes a long way to dispelling all the negative stuff you're talking about. And that's what keeps me in this business. I mean, every year I'm like, God, why didn't I do something else? And every year I'm like, yeah, but the opportunity is so good.
This is it.
If you're willing to be authentic, there's such opportunity in this space.
So. Well, we appreciate it. I mean, we appreciate your honesty, not only on the podcast, but just in the business and bringing insight to us.
Thank you.
It's needed, like you said. And we're excited to continue to watch what you get into and what you write about, what you talk about, and we'll stay in touch.
All right, what's the rapid fire thing?
We're going to go on the right. Yeah, now we're like, wait, what's going to happen now? We're going to go quick for you because you got to get going. We're busy. We got things happening. So what I'm going to do real quick is, I mentioned this before, is I'm going to take you out of the insurance business.
All right.
What business would you be in?
I think I probably would be in real estate.
Yeah.
if I had to stay in the finance world, not in the insurance side, I think I'd be on the structured product side. I'd work for a bank and do structured notes and structured products.
Yeah.
I love derivatives. I love options.
It makes sense. It's something to do with math. Would you be a math teacher?
You know, I've actually thought about being a university professor. I think maybe later in life I'll do something like that. I would not do math. I'd probably do econ. That'd be my thing.
Okay. So you were putting how many miles on a year? 200?
220, yeah.
220. All right. So you've been all over the place.
Yeah.
What's your favorite city to travel to?
Domestically?
Anywhere. You can do both.
Yeah, so I've done most of my travel domestically. I've been to 49 of the top 50 cities in the U.S. I like places that are underrated. And I think the number one most underrated place in America is Des Moines, Iowa. Des Moines punches way above its weight in restaurants, hotels, cool factor. Starting a little bit of buzz, but I think Des Moines punches above its weight. If it's just for travel, I love L.A. I love L.A., Orange County, that whole Southern California thing, I think, is...
West Coast is pretty awesome.
Yeah. If you can get out of the traffic, I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
So that's my...
Those are good ones.
That's the spot I get most excited to go.
That's a good one. So you read a lot, you study a lot. I'm sure if you read books or have read books.
I do, yeah.
Okay. If you were to pick one book that you think another entrepreneur should read, what book would that be?
Another entrepreneur. I say the guy who's changed my thinking the most has been Nassim Taleb. I don't know if you've read any of his stuff. If you can deal with his sort of writing style, he'll make you humble. So Black Swan is kind of his classic book. Okay. Fooled by Randomness was his first book, and I think probably one of his best books. But I've read everything he's ever written. I try to read about a book every 2 weeks. But Taleb is the guy who, once I understood him, he created a foundation for me to understand a lot of other things too. And I think a lot of my sort of humility in writing came from Taleb and his exploration of kind of the limits of knowledge. And it was huge. It was huge for me as a 20-year-old reading that book.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you sharing that with us. All right. So we're going to get into social media, which I know you're just a huge fan of social media, right? And there's a lot of social media, and I'm talking more on the business side. Do you have a favorite social media app?
I'm a terrible millennial. Like, I don't do any social media. I'm old school. And that part is because our industry is old school. And I know it's changing, but I'm like a classic email LinkedIn guy. Like I love LinkedIn. LinkedIn to me, if I'm going to do social media, it's LinkedIn.
Yep.
I don't tweet. I'm not on Instagram.
Well, LinkedIn's one of them. And LinkedIn, I mean, the amount of attention and, you know, the people that are on there. I mean, there's spam in all of them. And you got to fight through the noise just like anything else, which you've done before. You write an article and 7,000 people see it, and it kind of helps catapult you to the next level. But no, it makes sense, right?
Yeah.
And that's what we're looking for. Yeah. Besides this podcast being your favorite podcast, what is your next favorite podcast that you listen to?
All right, I have two. So I've been listening every week to a podcast called Econ Talk.
As the fire truck drives by. That's right.
I just went on the other side of the room. So Econ Talk, it's a guy named Russ Roberts, and he started doing it in 2006 before podcasting was cool. he's one of the best interviewers I've ever heard, and he gets fantastic people on there. And so that's my number one podcast. And number two, I've started listening to recently, is actually R&D and the QC. Have you heard of those?
I have not.
So it's two city councilmen here in town, a Republican and a Democrat, R&D. They are equal parts hilarious and informative, and it's kind of local politics. My mom was heavily involved in local politics, and so I've got a little bit of interest in that. But these two guys are, you know, if you want to like have hope that America will not get divided by clans, these are two guys who don't agree on anything and have a great time respecting each other, having fun, telling jokes, and it's a great podcast. And I, for just sheer enjoyment, that's my go-to.
Well, I think that's cool too, because you talked about it before, is like being polarizing a little bit. And it's okay to be polarizing. We're supposed to have different opinions. If we got on here and agreed about everything, it'd be kind of boring.
Yeah.
Right? So you can have fun with it.
Yeah.
What are you using to listen to your podcast? Or iTunes?
iPhone.
Yeah,
iTunes, yeah. Which is ironic, because I do a little bit of a podcast sometimes in the LifePod Review, and I don't put it on iTunes because I've got to put it behind the paywall.
Right.
And so
it's gated content.
Yeah,
but it's amazing how much it's, you know, Spotify, you get Anchor, you get Stitcher, you got Google Podcasts now just came out. So they just keep, it's just, like you said, it's becoming a cool thing to do now, I guess, right?
It is cool. And it's almost like, how much time do I have to listen to a podcast? Like,
so what speed do you listen? This is a question we used to ask a lot more. If you listen to a podcast, you listen at normal speed?
No. 1.5 to 2. Depends
okay.
On,
okay, good.
Depends. Yeah, I'm a 2.5.
I knew I liked you for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm a 2.5 for Audible books.
Okay.
So once I get into the narrator's voice.
Once you get it.
Yeah, and as long if it's reading, not conversation, I don't know about you, but like if I'm doing Audible, and I do a lot of Audible, I mean 2.5 is easily attainable.
Yep.
But hell no, are you kidding me? Going on at 1 time speed? Yeah. When my wife and I drive to the beach, she insists on, you know, kids are asleep or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
She insists on going at 1 time speed, and I'm like, I'm
spit
like,
it out.
I'm daydreaming between the words here. Like,
yeah.
Let's
you
go
gotta spit it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine listening to yourself at 1 time speed. I was like, well, you gotta spit it out
faster. Totally.
So no, I'm 2 times speed. I remember like kind of creeping up. Like you start at 1, you get in the kind of the head of how they talk.
Yeah.
You get to 1.5, and then you're 2, and the same thing, Audible.
You're
I'm at 2 for both of them, because to me it's like, if I could do something that takes an hour and do it in 30 minutes, like I was just on a plane and we were on the plane extra hours. It just was ridiculous. I must have listened to like 13 podcasts.
Heck yeah.
I mean, and it felt like I did it for like an hour.
Yeah. And as long as you don't miss anything. And that's the other thing too. Is like,
if you find something good, you can always go back, right?
Oh yeah. But it's also like, what am I doing? Like if I'm driving, yeah, 2 times, no problem. If I'm playing golf, sometimes I listen when I'm playing golf.
Right.
I have a little more trouble because I'm kind of thinking about the course,
you have
right?
Different things going on in your head.
Yeah, but I love podcasts. I wish I could spend a whole day listening to podcasts.
That's right.
But,
you gotta get on a plane again.
Yeah. That's
going
on
a long ride. Yeah.
Stare at the window. Mow
the lawn, right?
Yeah.
All right. Last question, we'll get you out of here. When was the moment you told yourself that you need to make it happen and you gave yourself no excuses?
Oh, man.
I'm sure there's many moments for you like this, but.
No, dude honestly, so when you say that question, what I'm thinking about is that moment where you sort of decide to make the leap. And I never had a moment where I felt like I was making a leap. Every time I've done that, it's just been the most obvious next thing to do. Like I remember the day I showed up to work at 24 years old and thought, oh, today's the day I'm gonna go quit to go start my own business. And I walk into my boss's office and I was like, this is it, this is the day. And she was like, yeah, we kind of thought this would happen.
Yeah.
You know, but I never had that moment where I thought, I've always kind of had backup plans and I've always had a variety of out, and it just felt like, yeah, the next step is for me to leave and go do this, and we'll see if it works or not, and I'm okay with kind of whatever happens. So, I don't know, a lot of people talk about the entrepreneurial leap, and I never felt like it was a leap. I felt like, honestly, it was a baby step, and it was just...
It's something you live then every day.
Yeah,
where you
absolutely.
Just do it. Like, you didn't, like, and I could look at the time you ran illustrations on WinFlex, or the time that you just spent 5 hours or 100 hours researching a product. There was no excuse. So like, well, I couldn't spend 100 hours because I got 2 kids. I had to do it. If it meant I had to stay up, there is no excuse behind it. I'll sleep later. You just do it. So you're kind of living that every day.
I do, and that's a great
But you don't tell yourself, maybe, well, I'm living it right now, right?
No, yeah. I don't. You know, honestly, look, I just love what I do. And so somebody asked me recently, hey, what are your hobbies? I like to work. I mean, I like to hang out with my wife and my kids, and I like to play golf when I have some spare time,
right.
Which increasingly doesn't happen as often.
I think like it's underrated to kind of go away from your business to work on business.
Yeah.
Like it's okay to have a staycation and just say, I want to read about this thing for an hour, or I want to write this, or I want to work on something. Business can be fun. It doesn't just have to be stressful.
If something is stressful, I don't do it. I mean, I'm the worst. I did make a terrible employee because I just like to do the stuff I like to do. And so for me, working on the business, creating assets, doing things I love, exploring the intricacies of what I'm working on. Yeah, that's what I love to do. And I guess what makes me sad is when I see a lot of my friends who work for the bank or whoever, mm-hmm. you know, and they don't like what they do. And they go to work and it's stress. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's like work should be fun. Work is fun for me. And to your point, working on the business, I mean, some of the best days of my career have been days where I listened to music and stared out the window of a plane and thought about what I was going to do for the next year and planned on that and got excited about it. And that's just, yeah, it's just, so, you know, I always wonder, like, am I a workaholic? And I just like to do things that I enjoy and I just happen to really enjoy work.
Yeah.
I can kind of see in 20 years, maybe I won't enjoy work quite so much and I'll go, like, I don't know, do something else.
Yeah.
But as long as I enjoy it, I'm going to keep doing it. And as long as I enjoy it, it's going to be my, again, wife and kids come first, and I really mean that. I think a lot of people say that, but they don't really mean it. I mean, I work from home. Like, I see my wife and kids all day.
Right.
And that's my favorite part about the day. But if I'm not with them and investing in them, and some, you know, friendships that I have, I'm working. Because it's just what I love to do.
Yeah.
So I feel blessed to be able to do that. I think a lot of entrepreneurs feel the same way. Like, some days suck. Same. But
of course.
But in the bargain, it's a good...
We always say it's a journey and it's a roller coaster ride. I love saying, and it's because it's true.
It's true.
And then if you do read a lot and you read the books about, it doesn't have the extreme examples like the Steve Jobs or the Jeff Bezos and the Phil Knights of the world, and you hear the roller coaster rides they've been through.
Yeah.
They've all been through it before, where your bank account doesn't look like, wait a second, this doesn't look good, you know, or how am I, you know, I just lost a client, or these things happen.
But
and
it's
life,
best.
And it is the best, right?
It's the best.
So to hear you say it and to be real about it and be like, it excites us to hear. That's why I love talking to entrepreneurs, whether they are a solopreneur and they work from home, or they have a small business that they built, or that, you know, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. It's just unique stories that these people have.
Yeah.
And it's so much easier than to talk to that person that's going through those other experiences than talking to the executive at the bank. No, but some executives at a bank, if they can find the good in that, then go have fun with it.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I worked in that life for 3.5 years. I met a lot of people who would say things to me like, I can't believe you ever went on your own. And I would say to them, look, some people are geared for some environments and some people are geared for other environments. And what you're doing here at MetLife or whatever company is honorable. Just don't stay there for 40 years if you really hate it.
That's right.
Go find what you love.
If you love it, love it.
And I found a lot of people at MetLife, for example, who were really good and loved what they did. And that is honorable. I mean, that is absolutely honorable. It's not my path.
That's right.
But it's honorable. And I think the biggest tragedy is people will spend... And think about it, people spend a third or more of their lives doing something they hate.
Yeah.
Because they either are making enough money that they can't see an alternative or a way to do something different, or they're just kind of waiting for that next promotion. They don't realize yet that you're going to make a little more money, you're going to spend a little more money, and you're going to be right back in the same trap. And it's like, you know, that can go on for like 30 or 40 years, and you wake up and you're 65 years old, and you're like, I spent my entire career doing something I hated.
That's right.
To make a few extra $1,000. Cut down your lifestyle and go do what you love. And you'll be more successful because you're doing something you love. Unless what you love is like something where you can't make any money.
That's right.
Like origami.
Or find something, right? There's variations of how much you love something, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So have a good family, have a wife, have her husband, and have good kids, and then love what you do, and buy a good bed to sleep in, right? Because you're spending so much time doing those things.
Bobby Samuel's some keys to life.
That's right.
You're kind of all keys to life.
That's right.
Let's be really simple here.
That's it. Well, Bobby, we appreciate it. What's the best way, after people listen to this, I know they're going to want to reach out to you. What's the best way people can reach out to you?
Just go to the website. So www.lifeproductreview.com, and my contact information's on there. And that's got my cell phone number, and I'm pretty accessible. So
that's awesome. Yeah. Well, Bobby, we appreciate you spending time with us.
Thank you.
Talking about your story, your journey, and all the good things you're working on. We look forward to continue watching what you're up to, and thank you again.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Bobby, it was absolutely awesome having you on this podcast. From your knowledge of the life insurance industry to following your passions, we know all entrepreneurs can learn from you. The perspectives from Bobby on his journey of building his own business and helping others in his industry are now perspectives you as a business owner and entrepreneur can use for yourself. And for that, Bobby, thank you. And for anyone looking to talk to Bobby about his journey or to learn more about the Life Product Review, we encourage you to reach out to him. If you have questions, feel free to reach out to me directly. You can find me on LinkedIn or contact me on Twitter and Instagram at Eric_Kaz. Thank you for listening to our KazSource podcast, Entrepreneur Perspectives, building and protecting your business one podcast at a time. Until next time, we're out of here. This podcast exists in large part because of CASCM, the content marketing business inside CASSource, Inc. CASCM is excited to bring the content marketing services used at CASSource to you. Learn more by visiting CASCM.com.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. It's a big deal to us. We hope you found value in it. And if you did, we would be incredibly grateful if you gave us a review on iTunes. Remember to subscribe to this podcast and feel free to share it with anyone you know. More than anything, thank you again for listening. We appreciate it.